pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Hey, Ms. Gregory, can we do the roll call?
Commissioner McLaren? Commissioner Maynard?
Here.
Commissioner Ramirez?
Here.
Vice Chair Smith?
Here.
Chair Fullerton?
Here. Next item is public forum. So this is the time for any member of the public to speak on any item that is not on the agenda. Ms. Gregory, do we have any members of the public wanting to speak?
Would any attendee who wishes to speak on an item not on today's agenda, please call. Pardon me? Would anyone who wishes to speak on an item not on today's agenda, please click on the hand raise icon now. And there is no one at this time, Chair.
Okay. Do we have any amendments or adjustments to the agenda? Director Imhoff?
Thank you, Chair. We do not have any amendments or adjustments.
Okay. So the first item on the agenda is the administrative agenda. Ms. Gregory, can you please read this into the record?
Item A1 is approval of the Planning Commission meeting minutes of Monday, May 9th, 2022.
Do we have any comments or questions?
Move for approval of the minutes as presented.
Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Okay. Can we get a roll call vote?
Commissioner McLaren? Commissioner Maynard?
Aye.
Commissioner Ramirez?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Chair Fullerton?
Aye. Hey, Ms. Gregory, can you please read the next item into the record?
Item B1 is a discussion action item. It's the general plan conformance findings for the capital improvement program fiscal year 2022 through 2023.
Okay, thank you. Do we have a staff report?
Yes, Chair. I'll kick off the staff report while Teresa Lopes is getting the PowerPoint ready. So good evening. And it's my pleasure, of course, to introduce the general plan conformance findings for the capital improvement program projects for this upcoming fiscal year 2022-23, which starts July 1st. This item is a joint planning and public works effort, and Teresa Lopes, the senior project engineer in public works, will be providing the majority of the presentation, and she'll be supported by the public works director, Charlie Eveling. While she's still working to get the PowerPoint up, I'm just gonna, oh, there she goes. All right, thank you, Teresa. Can you advance it to the next slide, please? So this is really a background slide, and it's a summary of what's in the staff report packet. And it just gives a little bit of background that the commission, you are required under Government Code Section 65401 to review the capital improvement program for conformity with the general plan and for this upcoming fiscal year. And the Government Code Section requires that you make this finding of conformance in advance of the City Council adopting the upcoming fiscal year budget, which they're going to do soon. They're required to do that before July 1st. And so just as a reminder, the CIP or the Capital Improvement Program is a budgeting and a strategic planning tool that's used to assess the infrastructure needs of our community. So we staff reviewed the 2022-23 list of CIP projects, and we found them in conformance with the general plan And you can find that the references in Exhibit 1, which is attached to the Planning Commission resolution in your packet, and it presents the companion general plan policies, and it goes project by project. And then the last bullet on the slide flags the fact that the fiscal year 22-23 CIP list is also consistent with the Public Works annual work plan and also the five-year CIP budget. And the general plan conformance matrix that I just referenced in Exhibit 1 to the Planning Commission resolution, it does include a much longer list of projects that go beyond this upcoming fiscal year, which is the focus of the presentation. And it includes recently completed CIPs for some context for you. It includes a number of other future projects that are listed, and they're just for informational purposes. And so I'm just flagging that the action that's before the commission, and Teresa will run over this at the end of the presentation, but is specifically for fiscal year 2022-23, and that's required by government code. And so that's it for the background for me, and Teresa will take you into the CIPs.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Wells. Good evening, Chair Fullerton and members of the Planning Commission. Ms. Wells mentioned, I'm Teresa Lopes, and I'm a senior project engineer with the Capital Improvement Program Division in Public Works. Also available tonight to answer any questions you may have is Public Works Director Charlie Ebeling, as well as some other members from staff, Public Works Division managers and project managers. So this first slide, I'm going to briefly go over our CIP project delivery process. You may be familiar with this process as you've seen it before. But typically when we're discussing our CIP projects and project phases, we use this terminology to really define where in the project delivery process a particular project actually is. And so we start with conceptual design, which is the earliest phase of the project delivery process. During conceptual design phase, we are basically trying to establish the scope of a project, looking at the feasibility of a project. Perhaps there's different alternatives that are being analyzed, and identifying potential impacts or constraints associated with the project. Our next phase we move into is environmental review, where we now have a defined scope, maybe some project alternatives, and we will look at those from environmental impact and environmental review, and if necessary, develop the proper CEQA documents, or in the case of federal funding, NEPA documents. Next phase, we move into design. And during the design phase, this is where we tie down the specifics of the project. We already have the scope. We know the alternative we're moving forward with, and then we'll determine project details. And once we have completed design, we're ready to go into construction, which is really the most exciting phase of the project, I think, because you actually get to see it built. So for the majority of the projects, and certainly our larger projects, we will bring a project to City Council at most of these phases for their input and approval. Now I'm going to move into our CIP project list. And as Ms. Wells mentioned, this is the General Plan Conformance Matrix Capital Improvement Program Projects list, which is included as Exhibit 1 to Attachment 1. And the list is separated into various parts. We have a listing of all our fiscal year 22-23 CIP projects, and these are the projects that are included in the 22-23 annual work program projects that we are currently working on. In addition, you will find in the matrix we listed on page 14, let me take a step back. So our current projects are listed on pages 1 through 13. Once we get to page 14 of the list, this is the listing of our recently completed CIP projects. And this is provided for information. These were projects which were completed during this past fiscal year. And then in addition, provided for information only, are a list of future projects which were identified in the city's Transportation Development Impact Fee Program Nexus Study. The current version of this study of the DIF and the Nexus Study went to City Council for action in February of 2019. The program is updated approximately every 5 years. And the development of the DIF is in conformance with the general plan. So the projects which are listed are DIF Nexus projects, which are listed in the DIF Nexus study, and are projects which were identified as transportation improvements necessary to accommodate projected build out increase of traffic volumes. So these are future projects which currently aren't included, which aren't included in our current CIP at the moment. The matrix also lists projects which were identified as improvements necessary to complete the city's bicycle and pedestrian network, as identified in the city's bicycle and pedestrian master plan, which was adopted by City Council in October of 2018, and this plan was also in conformance with the general plan. So both these sets of projects, which I mentioned again, are future projects, not currently CIP projects. So you will not be making a conformity finding on these for information only projects. Keep it there. So active projects and final design and or construction. I just wanted to highlight a few of our larger projects which are taking place right now. One is 9002, the Equifowler Extensions Hollister Roundabouts project. So currently this project is securing final design approvals from Caltrans. We're wrapping up the remaining right-of-way items, coordinating utility relocation work, and preparing to request allocation of construction funding from from the California Transportation Commission. Construction is anticipated to commence in this fiscal year, 22-23. Other big project, the Hollister Avenue Bridge project. Again, this project is currently securing final design approvals from Caltrans and the Santa Barbara County Flood Control District. And we are currently coordinating utility relocation work and preparing to request construction authorization from the Federal Highway Bridge Program. Construction is anticipated to commence in fiscal year 22-23, concurrently with the Equifowler project. Another project which is getting ready to go into construction is a combination of project 9007, the San Jose Creek Bike Path Middle Extent, and 9083, the Community Garden Project. So these two projects have been combined into one construction package. We're currently in final design on this combined project and anticipated to be ready for construction sometime this fall. Another project which is going out to construction very soon is 9099, which is a crosswalk at Calle Real Fairview Center, a pedestrian hybrid beacon. So we just closed bids on this project, and we will be going to council for award of a construction contract in June. We anticipate beginning construction a little later this summer, and just wanted to note that I know people will be looking for construction to take place right away, but we do have a long lead time on some of the equipment required, such as the poles, controller cabinets, and mast arms, which are all affected by supply shortages. And we anticipate that lead time to be somewhere around 4 to 5 months, and this is based on the projects that we just recently completed of this type. Another priority project is 9114, the Hollister Avenue Old Town Interim Striping Project. We are bringing an update to City Council at the first meeting in June to discuss project options and then to start the final design on that project. And I just would also like to mention, though they're not a CIP project per se, but the city or the Public Works has been moving forward on our annual pavement rehabilitation projects. The current one for this year is nearing construction completion, and we are ready to go out to bid for the new project for the upcoming year. And we're looking at going out to bid in July for that one. And also ongoing is our annual concrete repair program. This next list of projects are projects which aren't as far along, some in conceptual design, some just starting design. And I'll highlight a couple of them. The San Jose Creek Bike Path Northern and Southern Segments Project. We are in conceptual design and wrapping up the environmental review phase. On this project, we're getting ready to go out to circulation with the CEQA document in the next month or so. And that one is moving forward. Also, the 9053 Cathedral Oaks Cribwell. We completed some geotechnical studies of the area, and we plan to begin the conceptual design phase for this project and are working on releasing an RFP to select a design firm to get this one going. Another highlighted project is 9079, the Goleta Train Depot. So the project is currently in design and moving forward. An EIR for the Train Depot project was approved by the City Council in January of this year, and design is at approximately 65%. Construction is targeted to commence in fiscal year 22-23. And next, I'd like to highlight some of our newer projects which were added to the list. So the ones that I mentioned before are projects that were on the list last year that we brought to you. And these listed projects here are new projects which we've added. The 9116 pickleball courts, and this is looking at expanding and constructing new pickleball courts. San Jose Creek Channel Fish Passage Modification Project. So this project is related to the Hollister Bridge improvements or replacement project. It's a requirement of the Fish and Wildlife. And so we need to make some changes to the current fish passage components of the channel in that area. 9118 Elwood Coastal Trails and Habitat Restoration. We're also working on two drainage repair projects. One is 9119, which is located at the end of Elwood Beach Drive. There's some erosion happening there, so we're looking at conceptual design on how to make repairs to that area. And then the 9120 Evergreen Park drainage repair. If anybody's been out to Evergreen Park, they probably noticed an area that is currently fenced off. There's some erosion due to a failing drainage system at that location. So we are in the conceptual design to make repairs to that system. Some other projects, 9121 Goleta Community Center ADA improvements. So this project is looking at providing ADA improvements at the community center, and it is separate from the larger improvement project at the community center. This one, we're just breaking out and looking specifically at the ADA improvements. We have 9123, which is Lake Los Caneros Master Plan. 9124 plans to install a new traffic signal and do intersection improvements at the intersection of Fairview and Stowe Canyon. And then 9125, this is to add rapid flashing beacons at Kyrial and Jenna, which provides a crossing to a newly improved park. And then also looking at the Lake Los Caneros pedestrian bridge on how to repair that facility. And these are some of our recently completed projects. The miscellaneous park improvements, which was just completed last month. We have 9087, the PHB on Kyrial near Encina Road. That project is complete and functional. Also, that should be 9088, not 9099, but 9088, where we completed the installation of RRFBs at 3 school zone crosswalks along Cathedral Oaks. And then I mentioned the current 2122 pavement rehabilitation project, which will be complete by the end of June. We're anticipating the end of June. So to wrap it up, the recommendation to the Planning Commission is to adopt resolution number 22 next in line, entitled a resolution of the Planning Commission of the City of Goleta, California, finding the fiscal year 2022-2023 capital improvement program is in conformance with the Goleta General Plan Coastal Land Use Plan pursuant to section 65401 of the Government Code. And that ends my presentation. I'd like to open it up to any questions.
Do we have any questions for any of the commissioners? Vice Chair Smith?
Yes, thank you. It's always fun for us to see this update, because I know we don't see these all the time. So thank you for that update. And I really want to commend the Public Works Department, because I know that you all have been really busy the last few years and doing a lot of really good work. I had a couple questions. One is, I just didn't know, in terms of your interactions with council or in thinking about our goals for safety in our community, how much current collision data is informing any of the, at least in terms of looking at projects focused on streets or pedestrian safety, sidewalks, how much any of the collision or injury or fatality data is being used in terms of prioritizing those projects?
I think I'll fill this one, Teresa, Ms. Lopes, Commissioner Smith. In general, I also serve as our city traffic engineer, and on a day-to-day basis, overall, we're always watching our collisions. We do receive the collision reports when they're filed by the sheriff's department. And then often what we do for particular roadway projects, as we are doing that surveillance, we're looking at those collision rates. And so often as part of a traffic study. So as Ms. Lopes mentioned at the very beginning, when we start a project, we have that conceptual design phase, and we always think about what studies we might do for a project, everything that might range from geotechnical studies, hydraulic studies, but also traffic studies. And a traffic study might look at what collisions were in that area, and then we use a national standards and California standards to first calculate the collision rates and also compare them to similar facilities throughout California. So we don't just actually look at the collisions themselves, which are very important. We want to see if there's any trends or issues, safety things that could be improved. But at the same time, we do also want to understand how that roadway is performing in terms of collision rates. And we do have a way of doing that, following a national standard and comparing it to statewide rates for similar roadways. So it's the data is really well collected throughout the state by the California Highway Patrol, the various police and sheriff's departments. And then it's published in a collision data book by Caltrans. So we actually can look at all that and really compare how our roads are performing to the statewide system. So there's a lot to it, but we do look at it.
That's great. I think it's a balance. I was thinking about, circumstances where, community might raise concerns about intersection X, but data actually shows that intersection Y is more problematic, and that balance between not only being responsive to our community, but then also staff's role in highlighting what, potentially if data is showing otherwise. And I know that that's a fine balance, but that's good to know. Thank you for that information. The other question I had, I don't know if folks know off the top of their head, I have vague recollection that as part of the bike path project along Hollister here along the west side of town, the bike path that goes out towards the Elwood School, I have vague recollection of discussions about potential traffic signaling at Canning Green and Hollister. But I don't know if like that got, and I don't even know if that was feasible, or I just recall some vague discussion around that. And I don't know if that just got put aside or if that is even still contemplated as something that's going to happen. If anybody, does anyone know?
Vice Chair Smith, I can kind of jump in a little because I do remember those discussions. And initially we were looking at a signal at Canning Green as part of that project design. And when we looked into it further, it was determined that, that location didn't meet any of the warrants required for a new traffic signal. There weren't really that many issues, collisions happening at that particular intersection. So at the time, we said, okay, we'll look at that again in the future. I can say as of now, it's not included in the CIP, but again, like Director Ebeling mentioned that, we're always looking at the collision data around the city. And if we see an uptick in that area, it would definitely merit looking at that project or that component again.
Got it. Thank you for that update. And then sort of on that note, and I didn't know which section, this reference is more of a potential future project. It was 9044 is the widening, potential for Hollister widening west of Stork, which is a long stretch. So I didn't know if that was, I just wasn't sure in terms of, when we've looked at this before, I just hadn't recalled that specific language on the list. So I didn't know if that was in relation to around Hollister Village or further west.
Vice Chair Smith, that one, you're correct. It is in front of Hollister Village. Mm-hmm. So it was from, what's that road called? Glen Annie Way? The little outlet there, between Hollister Village and Stork. So currently there is a pocket there. Well, it was to widen and extend that right turn lane pocket. Okay. So it was right in front of Hollister Village. Maybe if I can fine, I can pull up a picture, but yes, so this project is still in the CIP. It's not actively being worked on right now, but it's identified as a project in the coming future years that we would take another look at that.
Got it, thank you. And then I was just curious. I'm always interested. I think every time you guys come, I always raise the issue of the impact of the Cortona apartments and any pedestrian activity related to Hollister. And I guess that also gets to the Stork Hollister intersection. And I just didn't know, you know, I know that there's actual, I believe, right, there's actual residents who are in now. And I just didn't know if there had been any updates since now that Cortona is a reality.
I'll go ahead and take that one, Commissioner Smith. It's interesting with Stork and Hollister, that intersection, that's our major intersection in town. And we always are looking at ways to improve it. So in the past, that previous project you were mentioning, where if you're southbound on Stork and you're turning right onto Hollister in front of Montecito Bank, that's called an acceleration lane. And that widening would potentially extend that acceleration lane towards Glen Annie Way and maybe even further to the next shopping center entrance. That project does have some incredible constraints. For example, it would require moving of one of the largest power poles in the area. That power pole happens to power all of that part of Goleta, all of Isla Vista, and all of UCSB all in one place. So it's an incredibly challenging utility relocation if we were ever to actually move forward with that project. But the reason why I bring up that project and what you're mentioning on Cortona is in the near future, as a director of the department and the city traffic engineer, I've already talked to the city council some and indicated that I would like to bring forward more of a study that looks at how that area, the whole Stork Hollister area, circulates. You have everything from multiple movements in front of the Target shopping center using the two-way left turn lane. You've got now Corona, Cortona, with the probably the higher volumes due to the the improvements or the developments that occurred on Cortona. Plus, you already have the issues or the concerns about how Hollister and Stork work, and actually going all the way to the other end of the that corridor, even further to the west. And how does the entire corridor work, and how does the corridor work heading towards Isla Vista on Stork? So these are things where we really do want to actually take more of a comprehensive look at it, understand where we have traffic signals, where we want to have traffic signals in the future, potentially even interconnecting those traffic signals with sophisticated computer systems that would run them as a group. And also looking at those, how all those turning movements work. For example, that left turn from Hollister into Cortona. At the same time, you have some people that really would like to go out on a limb and make the left turn from Hollister and shoot way over in front of the Jack in the Box, right? Mm-hmm. And so those are some issues where we would like to see some, not only circulation improvements, but also safety improvements to the corridor. So I think in the very near future, as Public Works, you may have heard Public Works is really struggling with staffing and hiring and the amount of consultants we're using, that kind of thing. But as we really get our get back up on our feet and get the department up and running, that's one of my primary things that I've talked to the city council already about, and I would really like to move that forward. And I understand exactly why you're bringing that up as a concern.
Thank you for your update. I support all of those efforts. I know it's been a challenging time for all employers right now. But then I think even looking at our future agenda item, like thinking about the housing element and looking at, you know, where we, I don't know, identify sites, all these things, and how it impacts kind of our streets and sidewalks is important. So thank you for that update. I appreciate it. I don't have any other questions.
Thanks. Commissioner Ramirez?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Just two or three questions. On the staff report, page 2 of the staff report, there's a sentence that says in the top paragraph, the purpose for planning commission review is to ensure that the capital improvement projects in the CIP meet the objectives and policy standards established in the general plan. And are the objectives and the policy standards, are they the last column of the conformance matrix? I'm not sure who can answer that question.
Yes, Commissioner Ramirez, yes, that is correct. Okay.
And then one of my other questions is, there's a number of course, capital improvement program projects listed in this matrix. Does staff or does this any of our consultants, do they map these projects on a map of the city to see where they would be? Is that something that in terms of we wanted to visualize where these projects were taking place? Does staff have some use anything like that?
Commissioner Ramirez, yes, we do. We have, you know, we have, I guess you could say, exhibits for almost all of these projects listed on here. What we are working on developing, and I think it would help not only internally, but the public too, is putting together such a map where it has each CIP project located and making it interactive in a way where someone can have it on the city website and someone can click on a particular project or location and, you know, it'll pop up with what the project is at that location. So combining everything into one map is something that we are looking at working on. But we do have individual exhibits for every project.
And Commissioner Ramirez, I would add that as Ms. Lopes mentioned, you know, we do have various maps, such as if you were to look at our bicycle and pedestrian master plan, of course, there's maps in there where those projects are located. There's maps related to our development impact fee program. But as Ms. Lopes mentioned, we do have a desire and a goal to create a comprehensive map. And to take that even a step further, I've been in talks with both Caltrans and UCSB about that, because UCSB has a number of significant projects, as does Caltrans. Caltrans will be replacing bridges, for example, on US 101 and on State Route 217 in the near future. I think that's something where if you look at how UCSB is doing projects, how Caltrans is doing them their projects, and then of course our myriad of projects that we're doing, having a comprehensive map would be really great. It is something we haven't started yet. It is highly dependent on how I can allocate that with staffing, but we definitely have a goal to get that done in the near future.
Thank you, I appreciate that. And I hope that is a goal that the city can achieve, because, you know, when we have conversations with the public, you know, I think the public, it's important for the public to kind of see, you know, where, you know, our resources are being, you know, directed and where our time, effort, and dollars are being spent. And I think that there's sometimes a perception that certain areas of the city are, you know, get more resources than others. And I think that in the housing element item that's after this, they had some great visuals of underutilized sites, and they just had a variety of things that helped kind of just paint a picture of what we were trying to achieve. And I think that it would be in the community's best interest to be able to see where these projects are taking place, and maybe not some of the conceptual design, because maybe those are really too far off into the future. But at the very least, you know, those that are a little bit more you know, advanced, I think that might be helpful. Nothing else, Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Ramirez. I have just one question. So the list that you identified with the active projects in final design or construction, Other than those projects, if any of the other projects that are on the list that are in an earlier phase, is there any chance that any of those projects will actually be done this year? Or is it really, if it's not in final design and construction now, those would likely be in a future year?
Thank you, Chair Fullerton. I'm going to take a look here really quick. So we did identify that there are some projects that would be going to construction in this next fiscal year, even though they're not listed on, you know, this first page where it was. Actually, I'm going to share my screen. Sorry. Okay, there we go. The active projects and final design and construction. And there are some other projects which right now are in earlier phases of design or conceptual design. And a couple that I thought I'd point out that we are anticipating to go to construction this fiscal year is the Goleta Train Depot as one project. Another one, the 9062 Stork Road, Hollister Avenue Transit, Bike Ped, and Median Improvements. We're in design on that now, and we're moving that forward. And towards the end of this next coming fiscal year, we plan to be almost complete with design on that one. So that's just a couple.
Okay, thanks. And one follow-up question, how many of the projects on this list are still maybe don't have a budget? I guess my question is, are there some projects that are moving along, but there's not actually a budget for them yet?
Yes, that's definitely correct. As some of them, we do have budget for earlier phases, but not for latter phases, such as maybe we have some money for conceptual design, but we don't have budget, you know, for the next phase of design or construction. But I am not prepared to give you a number on which ones.
I just wanted to clarify, the expectation is just because we see them on this list does not mean that it is actually fully budgeted and ready to go.
That's correct.
Thanks. Are there any other questions from any of the other commissioners? No questions? Okay, do we have any, Ms. Gregory, are there any members of the public who would like to speak?
Would any attendees who wish to speak on this item please click on the raise hand icon now? Chair Fullerton, I do not see anyone at this time.
Okay, do we have any other discussion or comments from the commissioners? Commissioner Maynard.
I didn't have any questions on this one, but I just wanted to say how impressed I am at the work that the city's been doing. Whenever we get this report, I'm just always very excited about all the work that has been done by the city and all the projects that are coming down the pike that are so well informed by the public feedback that we've received and the guidance that our community has given to us. And when I look at this project set, I can really see a lot of those priorities that we've heard consistently from the community. So I know that a lot of hard work went into this, a lot of grant writing, a lot of work to pull all of the resources and the pieces together to make this happen. So I just really want to thank the city for your incredible work on all of the projects that are going into the CIP. And that's all I've got for today.
Thank you, Commissioner Maynard. So if there are no more comments, do we... Does anyone have a motion? Vice Chair Smith?
Sure, let's see if I can get this here. I will move to adopt resolution 22, entitled Resolution of the Planning Commission of the City of Goleta, California, finding that the fiscal year 2022-2023 capital improvement program is in conformance with the Goleta General Plan, Coastal Land Use Plan, pursuant to section 65401 of the government code.
Do we have a second?
I'll second.
I second.
I think Commissioner Maynard seconded. Can we get a roll call vote?
Commissioner McLaren?
Aye.
Commissioner Maynard?
Aye.
Commissioner Ramirez?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Chair Fullerton?
Aye. Great. Ms. Gregory, can you please read the next item into the record?
Item B2 is discussion and action item. It's the draft 2023 through 2031 housing element review.
Great, thank you. Do we have a staff report?
Yes, good evening, Chair and Commissioners. Before we start the presentation, we'll kick off the virtual Spanish interpretation. So go ahead, Viviana.
Okay, good evening, everybody. Can I ask, please, the host to activate my colleague, Carla Martens, as interpreter number one, so the attendees can see the icon to choose interpretation. Okay, perfect. Okay. So my name is Viviana Marzano, and together with my colleague, Carla Martens, we are going to be the interpreters into Spanish today. If you are bilingual, English and Spanish, you do not need to make any selection. Buenas noches, soy Viviana Marzano y junto con mi colega Carla Martens vamos a ser las intérpretes de inglés-español hoy. Si usted es bilingüe inglés-español, no va a tener que hacer ninguna selección. Si usted está conectado con una computadora o una laptop, haga clic en el icono de El Mundo en la parte inferior derecha de la pantalla. Haga clic en Interpretación de Idiomas. Haga clic en Español o Spanish. Si usted está conectado con un teléfono o una tableta, haga clic en el menú de tres puntos. Haga clic en Interpretación de Idiomas. Seleccione Español o Spanish y luego Done o Finalizar. If you are connected via a computer or a laptop, you will see a globe icon at the bottom right-hand side of the screen. Click on the icon, click on Language Interpretation, and select English. If you are connected via an iPad or a phone, click on the three-dot menu, select Language Interpretation, choose English, and then Done. The interpreters request that the presenters and the commissioners choose a language in case the interpreters need to communicate any message in Spanish from the public. If there are no more questions about interpretation, we can proceed with the meeting. Si no hay más preguntas sobre interpretación, podemos continuar con la junta. Can the host please enable me as interpreter number two?
All right, thank you, Viviana. We will go back to the introductory slide. Thank you. Again, good evening and welcome to the second draft housing element meeting. And tonight's team is the same team from our May 9th meeting with you. That's Andy Newkirk and John Douglas and Peter Imhoff. And then our legal team, Winnie Kai and Brian Bouillon. On May 9th, we introduced the draft 2023-2031 housing element to you, and that staff report and presentation included details on the state housing element requirements and presented the content of the draft housing element. And that's all attached to the staff report for tonight. And at the conclusion of that May 9th meeting, you continued the item to May 23rd tonight. And tonight we will focus our presentation on two possible program changes to the housing element that's in response to your May 9th comments. And then we have some responses to the questions that you asked on May 9th. And we're hoping that the outcome of our meeting tonight will be a recommendation to the City Council, because as you'll hear in the presentation, we need to transmit the draft to the state for their 90-day review at the beginning of July. So the agenda that's suggested is consistent with the format from our May 9th meeting, and that's just starting with the staff presentation, followed by commissioner questions, and then public comment. And then after that, we'll be seeking your action on the recommendation. So if I have agreement with that, we'll just proceed.
Yes, sounds good.
All right, thank you, Chair. And so the presentation topics will pick up where we left off on May 9th, and they include some background with context for this item tonight, which is a review of what we presented on May 9th. And then a summary of the issues that were discussed on May 9th. And again, that's that one revised program, one new program, and then four discussion topics in response to some of your questions. And then we'll detail the next steps and contact information again. And finally, again, the action on that recommendation. And I'll just emphasize again that action tonight will give us some time to get your recommendation together for the City Council, and that meeting scheduled for June 28th. That's a special meeting. And again, the action's critical to the city meeting statutory deadlines for the state's review of our draft housing element at the beginning of July. I think I might've made that point. All right, so for the background, as you know, the housing element's a required part of our general plan, and it establishes the policies and programs essentially for maintaining, improving our housing, and also accommodating the city's assigned share of housing needs under the state required regional housing need assessment, or RENA, the acronym. And we talked about RENA at length back in June and August in 2020, and then again in March 2022 and at workshops. And then we also talked about it on May 9th. And then the second bullet is just a reminder that our housing element updates required by state law, and it's referred to as the sixth cycle. There have been five, and now the sixth cycle of housing elements updates since there were comprehensive revisions to the state housing element law in 1980. So as you know, State Housing and Community Development Department, or HCD, has that oversight and authority for reviewing and then also issuing opinions regarding compliance with state law. And the finding of housing element compliance by HCD is referred to as certification of a housing element. Right now, our housing element has that certification. And certification is required for cities for eligibility for certain state grant funds. They're really important grant funds. And then they also support our local land use authority. So on May 9th, and then in tonight's staff report, we reviewed the housing element update, the public outreach process. And that was including, if you remember from that staff report and the presentation, there's extensive series of study sessions and workshops and public meetings and a survey. And the draft housing element was prepared in consideration of this input. And so that draft element was published on May 2nd, 2022. And the existing adopted housing element served as a foundation for that update. So you'll see in that packet from May 9th, there's an underlined strike through, so you can see what changed in the policies and programs, or what we're proposing to change. And that May 2nd date is important because it's the start of the statutory 30-day public review that ends on June 2nd for our housing element. And then that last bullet, of course, you considered the draft on May 9th, and we are concluding that review tonight. And then your recommendation will be forwarded to the City Council on June 28th and really acknowledging that it's a tight turnaround to meet these statutory requirements. But so far we're making the schedule, so we're doing okay. So let's talk about the first item. It's in the staff report. It's one of the items we talked about at length on May 9th, and that's short-term vacation rentals. It was, again, highlighted on May 9th, and we'll just start with right now, the short-term vacation rentals, or STVRs, are regulated by the Goleta Municipal Code, Chapter 5.8. So not in Chapter 17, which is zoning, it's in Chapter 5.8. And there's no specific limits based on the land use. And so what we did in the draft that you considered on May 8th is we wrote a new subprogram, HE 1.7, and that would require the city to monitor the impact of short-term vacation rentals on the existing housing stock and consideration of changes to regulations, if needed, based on annual monitoring. And the Planning Commission and also members of the public expressed concern about deferring action to further regulate short-term vacation rentals and a few other concerns. So we proposed changes to HE 1.7 that's for your consideration. And so what's in the staff report is also presented on the slide. And so starting with the title, so we're proposing to not just monitor, but also address the impacts of short-term vacation rentals on existing stock. So it's taking a little bit more of an action there with the title change. And then we added specificity to the monitoring requirements to ensure that the city would address unpermitted short-term vacation rentals, meaning basically enforcement of the permit requirement in Chapter 5.08 of the Municipal Code. And then we also added a requirement for annual reports that would summarize the monitoring and compliance effort and would provide more detail on existing short-term vacation rentals. And we like list out in the new or the revised program owner occupancy, like if a corporation is operating a short-term vacation rental, what type of a short-term vacation rental it might be, like is it the whole unit, is it a guest house, or is it a bedroom? And then we also added a requirement for considering additional regulations to address the impacts of short-term vacation rentals on residential neighborhoods and on the city's existing housing stock. So we captured that neighborhood concept along with how many houses we have. And then the potential regs we list out would consider factors like possibly short-term vacation rental caps, separation between STVR's requirement and then owner occupancy requirements, perhaps different regs based on the type of short-term vacation rental, like if it's an entire unit, guest house or bedroom, and then possibly limits on the number of short-term vacation rentals that are owned or and or operated by one person or an entity. So there's a lot there that we changed and expanded upon, but it wouldn't limit us. We can always add to it as we move and learn as we're doing the monitoring. And then finally, I think really important, we added a specific time period of 2024 for the city to consider changes to our regulations. So that holds us to it by putting it in the program this specific time period. So that's it on the short-term vacation rentals. And it's actually kind of was a lot of change there. And so the second program change, it's in the staff report, is regarding primary residences. And you expressed concern regarding like corporate or outside investors or owners purchasing units in the city and then using the city's housing stock as second homes. And we prepared a new possible program, which is numbered HE 1.8, that would address this concern. And then I'll flag that in the event that these units, like the corporate use or second homes, are being used by investors, for example, if it's being used as a short-term vacation rental, the revised short-term vacation rental program in HE 1.7 that we just reviewed would address the issue. So in the event that these units are being used for kind of part-time use, again, for like that corporate use or for a second home that's not a short-term vacation rental, then this program would require city staff to conduct research. And that would be before identifying any potential actions that the city could legally take to address the situation. And then that new program is shown on the screen. It also includes a 2024 time period for reporting to the city council to consider possible changes to city regulations. So that's it for the policy change, the program changes. And Andy Newkirk is going to walk you through some of the discussion points that you had raised on May 9th.
Thanks, Anne. So one of the items that came out of the conversation on the 9th was, you know, how do we incentivize new housing development? And we follow up with that meeting and discuss this internally a little bit. And we had been discussing kind of these topic areas or the incentivizing housing prior to May 9th, but we didn't articulate what we saw as kind of the ways in which that could be achieved. So there's a kind of a large chunk of the staff report discussion that looks at how we can incentivize new housing development and what programs we think are already in the draft housing element that at least in part addresses some of these topic areas. So the first is reducing fees. You know, overall, to get through all the approvals and pay all your impact fees, there's a table in the technical appendix that kind of run throughs all the costs associated with getting a new dwelling unit to certificate of occupancy. And they're quite substantial for various reasons, both the processing costs and the impact costs and the utility costs. We do have program AG2.4F, which is to revisit our beneficial projects resolution, which provides reduced or waived impact fees for certain types of development within the city. And so without prejudging exactly what that would look like, the program highlights the looking at potentially reducing or waiving fees for 100% for affordable housing and particularly 100% affordable housing projects. Right now there isn't such an explicit waiver of fees in that beneficial projects resolution. So that's one way we've addressed reducing fees as an incentive to see new housing stock get developed. In terms of relaxing development standards, there are several sub-programs that we flagged in the staff report. One is looking at HE 2.1D, which is looking at how we define and process mixed use development and creating some more flexibility in how that could work on a project on multiple lots. That's something we identified as some, you know, way that we could provide greater flexibility for commercial development that's on multiple parcels that's looking to do mixed use, that we don't require it all to be on the same lot, but part of an overall one approval or one development plan, typically. We also have HE 2.3D, which is looking at potentially reducing parking, in particular for studio and one bedroom units. We've discussed that before, but we raised those standards, the requirements with Title 17. So we have a program to look back at that and potentially reduce those parking standards. We also noted in the staff report that we do provide some flexibility already in Title 17, especially with discretionary approvals. We have something which we call adjustments. Some people might think of them as modifications, but then there's also non-discretionary projects can also get a modification as well. And those, there's certain findings that are needed, but essentially there's a suite of development standards that an applicant can seek to alter through the approval process. And that includes things like heights and setbacks and parking requirements. So there already is that baked into our regulations that an applicant can seek those alterations. And then finally, we have program HE 2.4A, which is a highly revised program that now focuses on the city continuing to properly apply density bonus law, state density bonus law. And I think in the staff report it mentions is that density bonus law is a bit of a misnomer at this point. There's actually some people that refer to it as development bonus law now, because it's really much beyond density. If you have a certain amount of affordable housing, income restricted units as part of your project, You qualify for the you may qualify for a density bonus under state law, and then you can get more units as part of your project. But you can also get waivers of development standards, things like heights and setbacks and all those various things. And the city is fairly limited in denying those requests. So there already is state law in place, and we implement it according to the state law, where if you provide a lot of affordable housing as part of your project, you already get, you know, there's already this massive incentive under state law where you can essentially alter our local standards. So we wanted to flag that because that exists, and projects in the past have used that. Pending projects have requested density bonus. So that is a real incentive that is already in state law and in our local regulations in Title 17. So we just wanted, I think that was it on the development standards. Expanding where multiple use development is allowed, this is something we've touched on a few times, but we did not propose any significant changes at this point. We're trying to stay true to the general plan vision of build out at this point. And as we've discussed with our sites inventory, we really looked at mixed use where we already have it allowed, as that's been envisioned in the general plan since really the adoption in 06. And seeking ways to support that mixed use development where it is currently allowed. That's really where we've kind of focused some of our attention at this point in the housing element. And then the final category is simplifying the permit process. So we have a couple of programs, HE 2.2C and 3.2, I can't read my handwriting, E, I think, for live work units and large residential care facilities, and reducing the permit requirements for those types of special needs housing. However, we didn't propose more dramatic changes to permit processes as when we've kind of flagged that for discussion earlier, including our March 14th workshop with Planning Commission. There was fairly significant hesitancy to look at that avenue for incentivizing more housing development. So at this point, that is not proposed. But those are kind of the four categories we saw as kind of main points where certainly as it relates to kind of local control, those are the categories where we could incentivize new housing development. There are a couple other topics of discussion that we just wanted to touch upon in the staff report in this presentation, but that we weren't proposing any changes to. There's nothing in the staff report looking to revise any sub-programs or programs related to these topic areas. The first was tracking of ADUs and the rents. We didn't propose any changes tonight for a couple of reasons. One is it's really hard to get that data. There's no obligation to provide it. Even where we can get it at building permit issuance, it's not a mandatory field in the online application. We just ask for it and we try to get it. But we think kind of cold calling the applicants down the road, we're skeptical of how reliable and how good of information that we have we would get. And we're also, it's not clear what would be done, even if, you know, our assumptions when it was the building permit was issued, what we would do about it. We can't require income restrictions on those ADUs outright. We're limited to what we can require under state law. And they already have, even if we were to try to incentivize ADUs by reducing fees, if they can promise to maintain the unit at an affordable level, most, if not all of our ADUs qualify for a DIF waiver under state law. Anything under 750 square feet do not have to pay impact fees. And by and large, our ADUs that get permitted are garage conversions. So you're looking at 400 square feet or so. So we really aren't looking at impact fees for our ADUs. And we also think, just kind of big picture, if anything, we're probably undercounting how many ADUs we'll see in the eighth cycle. We had 3 years of data, so we had a pretty small data set to make our assumptions. And as we explained on the ninth, we took that 3 years of data, took the average for those 3 years and just multiplied that out by eight. But we have seen it. We saw a significant uptick between years one and two, and then years two and three were consistent. And we have a lot of ADUs in the pipeline. So if anything, we think we'll kind of overreach on our ADU estimate as it is. So we think the way we approach ADUs is pretty reasonable and fair. In terms of regulation of rental conditions, this is kind of a couple different comments, but things like the mandatory incomes, qualifying incomes for the rental rates, and you know, not allowing co-signers, et cetera. We didn't change anything, but we do feel like this is something that could get looked at as part of the tenant protection ordinance. We didn't want to change that program because we really want to let that process play itself out and see what can be done and what's reasonable, what's legal, et cetera. We our affordable housing implementation division is kind of part of the larger team as part of this project and is aware of the comments that are coming in. So those comments will be flagged and kind of will be kind of banked as that project will begin in the not too distant future. And then in transit oriented development, there's a question comment about the definition of TOD. The housing element doesn't have a lot of definitions. There's a couple things up front about just the affordability categories, but that's it. When we look back, it is defined in the general plan glossary. So we think a separate definition in the housing element would be inappropriate. It's not defined in Title 17, but the term transit-oriented development is also not used in Title 17. So we avoid defining terms that aren't used in the zoning code as well. So again, on these three topic areas, staff didn't prepare any revisions based on the summary in the staff report and what's just been provided. So in terms of next steps, Anne's touched on this a few times, but June 28th is a city council meeting. And essentially what we'll do is we'll repackage the draft based on any changes Planning Commission recommends and prepare kind of an updated housing element draft for city council consideration on that on June 28th. And we're seeking from them authorization to submit to HCD for that 90-day review. So ideally we will get that in right at the beginning of July. And that'll really take us through September for their review. And then that'll give us a fairly small window to address comments. We expect to get comments back. That's become standard. And then take an updated housing element, the hearing draft of the housing element to Planning Commission in December and City Council in January of next year, so that we could transmit an adopted housing element to HCD for certification by February 15th, 2023. So that seems like a long ways off when you look at all the benchmarks that need to be hit. It's actually a pretty short ramp up to that adoption. So we have a webpage where we've been posting, the workshop material, the material from the 9th, the survey link when the survey was live, and we'll post the video for this meeting, et cetera. As we move along, just that the material on that page will get more and more thorough. But that link is up there. And we just want the public at every opportunity to be aware that they can submit questions, comments, to housingelement@cityofgoleta.org, and that'll go to the full advanced planning team. So there'll be a lot of eyeballs on that pretty quickly. So we'll be able to respond to any individual that has questions, concerns, et cetera. I'm gonna skip over this and come back real quick. The recommendation is that we're seeking tonight is to adopt the resolution that's in the staff report, and that's to recommend to City Council submittal of the draft to HCD for review. We just want to, at the bottom there, it says include any additional changes in the motion. So the draft right now does not include those revisions to HE 1.7 that Anne presented earlier and in the staff report, and does not include an HE 1.8. So Planning Commission, if the maker of the motion wants to include either or the edits to HE 1.7 or add HE 1.8, as presented, or an alternative version, that should be made clear in the motion to adopt the resolution. Going back to commissioner questions and public input, just wanted to note that there were three public comments that were posted for tonight's meeting. One was from George Rellis, which reflected comments that he made at the May 9th meeting. So we feel like the proposed revisions to HE 1.7, in large part, address those concerns about kind of the detail and kind of the commitment to address the issues of short-term vacation rentals. We had a comment from Mr. Woodbridge that was really concerned with the high rents. For the market rate units, that's tough. You know, one of the benefits of our change to the inclusionary policy a few years ago was we can apply that to rental projects. So a project like Cortona that was referenced was approved prior to that change to our policy. So those are all market rate units. Some of the other projects mentioned do have inclusionary components or for income restricted units. And you know, our affordable housing implementation division tracks those and ensures that those restrictive covenants are being adhered to. But we fully acknowledge that the costs are a challenge. When you look at the SurveyMonkey responses, that's pretty widely acknowledged that costs both for rental and for sale units in the city are really high. And we've tried to add programs where we can to address those things, but it is gonna be a problem for a long time to come, we expect. Finally, Mr. Chapman submitted a comment addressing kind of past issues of discrimination in housing and, you know, addressing those issues moving forward. And I just want to bring in John Douglas briefly to just talk about kind of fair housing issues and how the housing element looks at kind of past discrimination, what can be done moving forward. So I'll pass it on to John at this point.
Yes, thank you. Good evening, Chair and Commissioners. You may recall from our previous meetings, we mentioned that there is a very expanded fair housing requirement that applies to this round of housing element updates that has not applied in the past. And so there is an entirely new section of the technical appendix that deals with fair housing issues. In the past, housing elements have always looked at the issue of discrimination, and there have been programs in the housing element that address the issue of discrimination, and the city coordinates with nonprofit organizations and other public agencies to try to respond to concerns where discrimination in housing may have occurred. Recently, the state legislature adopted a new law, and the state HCD adopted some implementing guidance to cities on how to go beyond the traditional issue of discrimination and look more at how local governments can affirmatively further fair housing, or it's referred to as AFFH, affirmatively furthering fair housing. So just for example, to go beyond the traditional issues of combating discrimination, the state now requires that as part of the housing element, we look at how the city might expand opportunity for disadvantaged groups within the city. And there is a summary table at the end of the fair housing analysis in the housing element that talks about meaningful actions that the city can take to address past patterns of discrimination through redlining or a variety of discriminatory practices in the past. And so the focus of expanding opportunity is things like encouraging and facilitating the production of affordable housing, as well as housing aimed at persons with special needs, such as disabilities and the homeless and so forth. And so there is program 3.1 that's in the housing policy plan that compiles a lot of that fair housing information and specific actions that the city would take. But it also goes beyond, as I say, it goes beyond just the issue of discrimination. And so all of the programs in the housing element that deal with facilitating the production of affordable housing also help to expand opportunities for lower income people and protected classes.
Thanks, John. So with that ends staff's presentation, and we welcome Commissioner questions at this point.
With any commissioner questions? Commissioner Maynard?
And then great, thank you. Couple of questions. Well, first of all, just a huge thank you to staff for all the work that you've done since our last meeting. You've really put a lot of thought into the feedback that we gave and the questions we asked at the last meeting. So thank you for that. couple of questions. Have we ever looked at potentially shorter staff reviews or priority for hearing documents when I was, or hearing dockets, not documents, dockets. When I was looking at City of San Diego, it looks like that's one of the ways that they did it, where they maintained their discretionary review, but they found other ways of sort of fast tracking by just giving priority to those projects. Do you think something like that could be feasible in Goleta?
I can touch on that. I mean, we can look at that. There is like certain streamlining requirements under state law, regardless of the type of project. So that could be a challenge depending on what else is in the door. I'll defer to Anne or Peter if they have any additional thoughts on that.
One thought I have is that that is something that could work well on the building permit side. On the planning permit side, where the pathway is laid out and where especially for larger projects, we have to go through environmental review and particular process steps, we move pretty much as quickly as we can. On the building side, we may have more flexibility for prioritizing, and prioritization has been raised as a possible incentive for other policy goals as well, including, for example, integration of enhanced sustainability features or other features of a project.
Okay. Great. One of the things that was talked about at the last meeting was thinking about in the community commercial areas that we've identified as potentially being underdeveloped, that they do have water permit. They have water hookups already for the commercial space, but residential space typically requires more water. If the units were particularly efficient, is it possible that they could be able to do a mixed use unit with using just like the existing commercial water hookup, or would all of those projects need new water to do it? Like, how far could you get with water efficiency and still exist in the existing water permit? And have you looked at that yet?
Commissioner Maynard, I think that's, we haven't looked at that particularly because that's so granular and so specific to each site. Different commercial uses have different water demand. They may have different water rights. They may have unused rights, but we don't have that detail at that specific level. I think generally speaking, broad picture, even efficient residential will demand more water than, you know, a lot of commercial uses. So there is, you know, under current Title 24, there's a lot more water efficiency than there was historically. So you may have like a much older commercial use that may have a higher water usage than a new residential, but it's really site specific. But one of the, you know, we do have a program where we really emphasize flagging the potential for mixed use when applicants are coming in. And that way, you know, one of the things where if we can promote the potential, then they can look at their water usage and see if things will pencil out where they maybe weren't thinking about mixed use before. At least we can kind of see what's possible, or, you know, suggest to applicants that they look at what's possible under their existing water rights. But yeah, such a thing would be really granular, and we don't necessarily have all that data anyway.
And the water rights are determined by the water allocation when they first got the hookup, or based on their current usage?
Someone else may want to correct me, but it's my understanding that it's, you have a historical entitlement. Either when you came in or, you know, from a long, long time ago. There are some sites that have kind of really old water rights. But yeah, it's not necessarily based on current usage.
Okay. And another question. So I was looking at our community commercial, and there, most of our community commercial allows for up to 12 residential units per acre, if I'm reading that correctly. How can we get to where we need to go in terms of like what you had potentially laid out in the RENA map at the 12 units plus density bonus allowances, which we have, or would we need to think about changing that limit of 12 units per acre to hit what we're hoping to hit with the RENA map.
And Commissioner Maynard, I'll kind of frame the response from the perspective that the way we presented our inventory in the technical appendix is using the general plan build out, as Mr. Newkirk noted in the presentation. And we do meet our RENA numbers based mm-hmm. on guidance from HCD, and mm-hmm. some of it's modified, but we do meet our RENA numbers mm-hmm. using our build out. It's noted that there's, you know, a program, or that we flagged, you know, that's a possibility that we could look at other standards. And if there's questions from HCD and we need to return back, mm-hmm. we'll come back and present to you after HCD does their 90-day review with mm-hmm. some alternatives. But right now, and we're not using all of our underutilized capacity right now. Mm-hmm. We're not using all of our commercial sites. We're using the ones that met the criteria that we laid out in that methodology that's mm-hmm. in the technical appendix. So we can, you know, look more. We have kind of a backup plan, right? Like a list of other sites and other underutilized sites that we would go down first for HCD mm-hmm. Before we would start looking at mm-hmm. land use, like changes to our zoning map or changes to densities and heights and things like that. Those are down on the list. We're trying to avoid that situation for mm-hmm. the community. And again, we have that's our fallback plan if we have to, but we think that we can develop our underutilized sites that it's allowed, and barring the water barrier, which is a pretty big one that HCD is not recognizing as a like massive barrier, we think that our inventory that's presented is doing the job.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just add, you know, for those CC sites, so 12 units per acre, we assumed 6 units per acre, and that was not necessarily that each site would get built at 6 units per acre, but that, you know, some sites might not get built, like just some realistic flexibility in our assumptions. And obviously that also doesn't include density bonus. So someone could come in at our max density and qualify for a density bonus and then go beyond 12 units per acre as well. So there is that, so some sites that come in from our inventory may go well above the assumed units that we included for those sites.
I'm going to pause there for right now.
Okay, Commissioner McLaren.
Thank you. Thank you all for your report. I had a couple of questions. What has been the vacancy rental rate for the past, or what's the vacancy rental rate currently?
Maybe while someone's looking, I think our vacancy rate is around 6%, which is around a percentage that is healthy for a rental economy, because it allows for people moving in and moving out and for landlords to clean up the place. So you're always going to see some kind of vacancy rate. And John, did you want to add to that? Or did I get it?
Nothing to add to that. I'm trying to find what the most recent vacancy statistic is.
In the staff report, I think it was at a 14% for rental housing vacancy, because we had talked about that at the last meeting. Yeah. It was 6%, I think, if you include housing.
No, in table 10A9 of the technical appendix, the vacancy rate listed, and this is ACS data from 2015 through 2019, is 6.3%. Okay. And so that might have changed a little bit, may have gone down since that data set, but that's kind of the latest and greatest we have posted in the technical appendix.
Yeah, because I was looking over this and looking at 1.5, talking about condo conversions. And it says if there is a vacancy rental vacancy rate over 5, or they're going to deny a conversion to ownership. But So I'm wondering what has it been in the last 3 years, and it seems rather high, because I don't want to get to a point where we are denying people ownership if they want to move on to an ownership of a unit that they're living in. I think that's a great way for someone to actually own a unit here. So it seems like our rates are fairly high. I don't know if we've ever gone lower than that. I don't know, is there a resource where we can look at those vacancy rates for the past 2 years?
Sure, and John can give that to you, but I did want to say that policy on that limit conversion of rental housing to condos, mm-hmm. That has been there since we've had a housing element. So that's just to hold on to that bare minimum rental housing. And John, I know you have all the stats.
And I'll just add on the HU1.5. The expectation though is that the renter wouldn't be the one converting. It'd be the property owner who is renting would then convert and sell. So it wouldn't necessarily be those existing renters would by choice be converting, or would even have the opportunity to purchase those new condos. So that's the concern as well, is losing that rental stock for existing renters.
Yeah, there is they do have first right of refusal there. And also there's exemptions if they're for low income and those kind of things as well. But yeah, in looking at this over, I want it, I don't want to lose, because I know we made a few changes to 1.5, but I don't want to completely lose that ability. And maybe John, you can give some of the stats over the years, like how often do we fall below 5%?
I don't have any statistics right off the top of my head or at my fingertips. We'd have to do some research to compile the longer term trends.
Okay. Yeah, because I think, yes, we're making a few minor changes to 1.5, but I think it's a good time to, and I know we're pressed for time as well in this housing element draft, but I think it's also, we should look at, okay, have we ever fallen below 5% within several years, or is it, you know, something that we can just keep at that level? Also, I have another question. With 1.7 and 1.8, the verbiage used was to monitor and research what's going on with the housing stock, in a sense. And I'm wondering if there's an idea how that research or monitoring will actually be done, and what's kind of the cost to do that.
Right. So for how are we going to do that monitoring and research, I'm going to let Director Imhoff respond, because he's working on work program updates that go to City Council, and he can probably add some clarification there.
Well, we're not making any updates to these specific policies, I don't believe. So this is something that we would need to develop more, I think, within the Advanced Planning Division. And I'm not sure, Ms. Wells, if you have, or Mr. Newkirk has developed this more at this point.
Okay, so the first one was the short-term vacation rentals. And so that is something that would be in finance, and that's already with finance. And they have a contract to research short-term vacation rentals. And then the second one, tenant protection.
I'm sorry, Ms. Wells. I didn't know that we were referring to those particular policies. The short-term vacation rental policy is going forward as an amendment, a suggested amendment this Wednesday to our annual work program. And so that policy would be worked on in conjunction with the finance department, as Ms. Wells indicated. And the intent there would be to look at the ways in which short-term vacation rentals affect our existing housing stock. And the finance department will be monitoring and tracking existing short-term vacation rentals and understanding conditions under which those are used. So for example, you know, how many short-term vacation rentals are there overall? What percentage of those vacation rentals are on properties that are owner occupied at least for a certain portion of the year, and which and what are short-term vacation rentals that become vacation rentals 100% of the time, i.e. don't have a benefit as a residence at any point in time. So just by way of example. And the tenant protection ordinance is a separate program that would be developed under our affordable housing program, and we'll be looking at ways to enhance a range of tenant protections. There is a description that I could pull up if you'd like that describes that in much greater detail.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Imhoff, I like misspoke. The HE 1.8 was the underused housing stock program, and that we just added that. So that will be something that's new that we'll have to add into our work program to research existing housing stock that's being used for other things than primary residence. So we'll have to put that together to be able to research that. But that's, you know, that's what we do in planning. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, Ms. Wells, Director Imhoff, I'm looking for a little bit more specificity, because like, how are we, or how will the finance department, for example, actually, are they going to compile a list of all the ADUs within the county and then look at various, I mean, like, how are they going to actually look at it, looking at taxes? Like, what?
Oh, right. I understand.
How are they doing that specifically? And with that, I'm just wondering, because if it is very intensive, well, then we might need to, you know, hire more staff or something like that to actually manage this. And this is kind of what I'm trying to understand.
So it's the short-term vacation rental research and monitoring is already on the finance department's work program. So they issue licenses to those coming in seeking a license. But they don't do a lot of enforcement. Like, they don't troll websites. They don't, you know, looking to see if there's vacation rentals that are being used in the city. If there's a complaint, then that will get researched. But they're, the way this program's written would be more proactive, though. We did meet with the finance director and they were already headed in that direction anyway. So what we put in the program are many things that they were already planning on doing. Again, when they find these short-term vacation rentals that are unlicensed, we will collect the payment from them and then we'll get taxes. And, you know, so there's some benefit to that. And go ahead, Mr. Newker.
Yeah, I would just add that in terms of the kind of that research, there's kind of third parties that can assist with that, but some of the bigger hosting sites also now work with local jurisdictions to provide that kind of geo-referenced information about the rentals. Like if you go on some of those sites, you get a general idea. If you go on and search, you know, unit in Goleta and you look on a map, you can more or less tell where they are, but they often will share that information locally now to work in collaboration with local jurisdictions to support local regulations. So there's multiple ways that can be done, but those systems are in place. And as Anne mentioned, finance is already planning on doing that work. So we don't see that as a particularly significant burden that we are adding at this point.
And to add to that Commissioner McLaren, my understanding is that finance will be relying on consultants primarily to assist, who are specialized in that, to assist with that monitoring effort.
Commissioner McLaren, do you have any follow-up questions?
I don't think I can use my audio.
We can hear you.
Oh, okay. It says it's not working. No, that's all the questions I have for now. Thank you, Director Imhoff and Ms. Wells.
Do we have any other questions? No, I have a question on HE 1.8, the underused housing stock. I know, I believe Ms. Wells mentioned, you know, one of the main things in looking at that is who owns the houses and if in an unused, you know, a second home is being used as a vacation rental, the HE 1.7 would pick that up. So what other, I guess, what other kind of research and issues does the city see that you might identify? Because, I mean, people can own two houses. I know people that actually live part of the year here, part of the year somewhere else, and they're not doing anything wrong by that, you know, and maybe, and some of them actually do rent their house when they're not here as vacation rentals. Some don't. But what are the other types of research that you might do in this area?
Well, as it's written now, we would be looking at any other purpose that someone's using a primary residence, like our corporations purchasing up our housing stock. We don't know, our outside investors buying up housing stocks, and I don't know, treating our housing stock as second homes, and that's what we want to look at, is just getting our arms around. Are these units being part, you know, in part-time use, like for corporations? And, you know, what could we do to try to, first, like, is, you know, what's the significance of the issue? Are, how much of our housing stock is being used for these other types of uses that aren't for our residents? That's why we titled it underused housing stock. And then we would present that situation, characterize a situation to council, and then they would tell us if they, you know, wanted us to do something about it or not. But because we don't have the information, we haven't done that research. We haven't looked at, you know, who's in our units, who's in the primary residence, how many second homes do we have? And right now we don't know exactly what resources we would use, but, you know, surely they're resources out there that we will find and be able to report back to council.
And Chair Fullerton, there are some things that we can regulate directly. There are other things that we can just create policy incentives for to encourage certain outcomes. So for example, in the context of short-term vacation rentals, there's nothing that prevents the city from limiting short-term vacation rentals where short-term vacation rentals are used 100% as such for the entirety of the year. But still make allowances for more limited short-term vacation rental use where the home is primarily occupied by the owner and only rented out occasionally or for shorter periods of time.
Okay, thank you. I don't have any other questions. Do we have any other questions before we move to public comment? Okay, Ms. Gregory, do we have any public comment?
Would any attendees who wish to speak on this item please click on the raise hand icon now? No, Chair Fullerton, no one's requesting.
Okay, so Commissioner comment. Do we have any comments about the proposed changes? Commissioner McLaren? You're muted.
Okay, there we go. I would say that it seems like HE 1.8 is, in my opinion, redundant. I think from referencing what we talked about last time at our last commission meeting, where a lot of the desire and the input from the public was to have more affordable housing and basically, if there are renters, more affordable rents. And monitoring underused housing, I don't see that as actually achieving that goal, except for kind of increasing more government influence in folks' kind of lives. So I don't agree with that, because I don't think it seems to me as unnecessarily increasing possible policy and regulation without actually lowering rents. So just to get things started, because I'm sure everyone has a lot of comments. That's just kind of my initial take.
Vice Chair Smith.
Yes, thank you. I generally support the changes as proposed. In terms of responding both, I just wanted to respond briefly to the comment that we received from Mr. Woodbridge. And this also gets maybe a little bit to Commissioner McClern's concern. Just for the benefit of the public, before, when a lot of these previous housing developments that came through, like Hollister Village, Cortona, the Los Carneros area, City of Goleta, it used to be under state law, the City of Goleta was prohibited from requiring a certain amount of units that be, you know, going towards like middle or lower income units. And then the courts made a ruling, and now the City of Goleta has the legal authority to require units deed restricted for middle and lower income levels. So the city has had to work within those constraints in the last years, and moving forward has that opportunity moving forward. I think Mr. Woodbridge raises the point that, you know, and particularly with the current water restrictions, you know, our current market is what we're dealing with. And I think there are just so many tenants like Mr. Woodbridge out there right now. Like every day we're hearing about it. Units are disappearing in hours, you know, listings are getting, you know, posted and taken down. It is just really crazy right now. And we do operate in a capitalistic market. It's really challenging. So I just wanted to acknowledge that reality that Mr. Woodbridge is facing is the reality that so many of our residents are facing right now. It is just a real challenge. And I think one of the most important, I think just housing is the most important issue that we face as a community right now. I just wanted to acknowledge that. His comments were also reflected in a lot of the previous comments that we saw in terms of the community survey that the city had done. But to Commissioner McClern's point, we do have some legal limits sort of on what a city can or cannot do. So, and I think information is helpful for policymakers, whether or not something is a problem or not. Maybe this issue of second homes is not an issue for the City of Goleta, and this research is done and everybody moves forward. I do know, you know, from what I understand from other communities, like you heard things about like Zillow was buying up all kinds of housing. They were testing out like automated purchases of single family homes and then trying to flip them. And then that ended up being a catastrophe for them. And so in certain communities, if you look at listings, right, Zillow is trying to offload all this stuff, and how does that impact a market, and how does that impact the actual residents that live in that city, right? What is the data that shows? And in other communities, you're seeing, you know, what is the impact if a corporate investor owns the majority of single family housing stock, what does that mean for a community and things like that? So I know in some of the larger cities, they're starting to see some of that. And maybe that's not something that's happening here or will impact here. But I raised it because it's sort of an emerging issue. And because we're sort of looking at the, you know, and I'm sure there's issues we can't even anticipate that'll happen in the next 8 years. But at least for me, where I was coming from is we have, you know, at least if you have, if policymakers have the data, they can act or not act, you know, once they have more information. So, and then just knowing that we're working in a world of kind of incentives or disincentives, and there's certain legal parameters. The city of Goleta, the other thing to Mr. Woodbridge's point, under state law, we're actually prohibited from putting in any rules regarding what's called vacancy control. So I noticed in Mr. Woodbridge's letter, he mentioned he had left an apartment unit and then was like looking at going back to that same apartment complex, and that the rates had really gone up. And under state law right now, it's cities can't prohibit, the landlords and the owners have the right to increase rates to market levels when a unit becomes vacant. And local jurisdictions like Goleta were actually prohibited from trying to regulate that or tackle that, at least in that direct way, to say, well, if there's a vacancy, you can only raise it 10%, let's say. So needless to say, there's all these like rules and restrictions that the city is operating within. And I know we as residents are kind of caught in the middle. So in any case, I would support the proposal as written. Thank you.
Commissioner Maynard.
Commissioner Fullerton, Commissioner Smith did such a great job of capturing some of that. I'll keep my comments shorter. But I support the additional language that was added by staff for this meeting in HE 1.7 and also HE 1.8. I really think it's important that we separate the creation of new policy to the collection of information. And so that's the piece I'll just add to Commissioner Smith's comments, is just that we can't make good policy without good information. We're not proposing an end to single family homes. We're not proposing restrictions on who can purchase homes or how many homes you can purchase. We're simply wanting to know more, wanting to understand the issues more, wanting to understand our housing stock more, so that later down the road, we can make really informed decisions. And so I think from that perspective, I support both 1.7 and 1.8. And I think the city is taking a cautious approach, an appropriately cautious approach, to focusing on collecting that information and that data as a first step. And really understanding it before we jump in and make policy, before we really understand our housing stock. And so that's where I think 1.7, 1.8 as written in today's staff report make a lot of sense to me. I have some smaller comments on other items, but maybe let's get through these two first.
Commissioner Ramirez.
Chair, I had just two questions that kind of came up as a result of some of the commissioner's comments. Would it be appropriate to ask staff that now, or should I just focus on the comments?
I think it's okay to ask now.
They're pretty benign, and I'm not sure which staff member would. I think in one of the elements, it proposes a 2-year kind of evaluation process of those short-term vacation rentals. can staff, and I can't remember which specific, if it was 1.7 or where, but is that, where did the 2-year time frame come through? I think it was like 24 months, or I think it was 2024, that's what it was. Can you speak to how we arrived at, how the city arrived at that year?
So Commissioner Ramirez, is kind of a couple things. We wanted to do something in the near term, but with the understanding that there's a lot of other projects, even out of the housing element, that were already committed in 2023. And that gives us a couple years to track data and to kind of build up a database of information. So it gives us a little bit of flexibility. With that said, it may come sooner than that. We kind of see these dates as kind of the outside target. So we wanted to be kind of a little bit honest to the other projects that are coming out of the housing element, but do something in the near term and give a near term target for making a decision on whether action needs to be taken. And if so, moving forward with that project. But it does give us a little bit of time, get a couple years of data and see if there's any trends, et cetera, as we're tracking that.
All right, then my last question is, does the monitoring of kind of the what's proposed in 1.7, does that have to take place via the housing element, or is there, can that be done by staff at, you know, outside of the housing element at any time if it wanted to?
Yeah, Commissioner Ramirez, I mean, that the housing element and the implementations are not, certainly not limiting of city action or staff work. So, you know, with short-term vacation rentals, that's overseen by the finance department. They were really planning on doing this tracking and reporting. We felt it was appropriate to put in the housing element because it really locks that in. And you'll see that reporting either independently, but also included in our general plan annual report. So it really forces our hand as staff to give good information back on an annual basis as to what we're learning. But additional work can be done outside of the implementation program. Other facets of short-term vacation rentals that we haven't considered in the edits could be reviewed as well. It is in no way limiting.
Thank you. Those are my only questions that came up, Chair. Apologize for asking them after.
Okay, thank you. I would like to just voice my comments for 1.7 and 1.8. Really, Vice Chair Smith and Commissioner Maynard pretty much said everything that I would say. I do support both of them, especially the one HE 1.7. I think that the short-term rentals is a bigger issue than we know, and I think it's only going to get bigger. So I think it's really great that we're being proactive and looking at that sooner rather than later. For the HE 1.8, my first inclination was a little more hesitant on, but in hearing the other comments and really the purpose behind that is to gather information. I do agree that that's useful, so I support that as well. And overall, I'm in support of making the recommendation, you know, for the housing element, including these two amendments. So, do we have any other comments? Commissioner McLaren? You're muted.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Chair Fulgen. We've had a very long history of high cost of living here in Goleta as a whole. And it seems like we've done or should have done a lot of research already in the problems and or the causes. And we talked about this on the 9th already, and we still are not completely certain, even with decades of trying to wrestle with this issue of why are the cost of living so high? Why are the rents high and things like that? So I just don't feel that more research or data collecting is the most appropriate allocation of city resources. And also, I think we really want to be clear on the purpose of this data collection. Yes, we've said, okay, we want to, you know, look at the underused housing stock. But okay, this is, you know, multiple year plan. What are we going to do if we find out, okay, there is a lot of owners who aren't living here or who are, or like we really haven't discussed or understood what the actual goals are. So we're doing all this data collection without actually understanding why. And I don't want to do something that's just haphazard, especially if it may come to the point of possibly restricting or penalizing or dissuading someone from having multiple properties or owning multiple units or different things. I don't want to get to that point. So I think we need to be very clear in what our goals are. And currently, I don't see that. And this is regarding 1.8.
Are there any other commissioner comments? We don't see any other. Oh, Commissioner Maynard.
I had three smaller comments that I think won't end up changing my recommendation for the motion, but I wanted to note them. The three are, I'd encourage the city council to consider further reducing fees for affordable housing projects. I know we already have some of that that's built in to our city language. Because I don't make the decisions on the rest of the budget and I'm not looking at the budget holistically, I don't want to put any numbers or specifics on that. I think that's for city council to do, but would encourage that city council continue to look at more options for reduced fees on affordable housing projects. The second that I wanted to mention is the idea of prioritizing the processing of building permits for affordable housing projects that have already gone through the planning process, I think is worth considering and pursuing. And I'll specify that to building permit process rather than planning permit, since Director Imhoff described very clearly that we're actually kind of already at as fast as we can go on the planning side. And I do support not streamlining our planning process further. I do think the planning process is critical. And then my last comment is on the transit-oriented development. I guess I just wanted to express a little bit of a caution here, but I'm okay with the current language because I realize as I was looking through the housing element, it's not very detailed and prescriptive in terms of exactly what those modifications would be for transit-oriented development. But I want to make sure that it's... The level of transit oriented, the level to which the project is transit oriented matches with the changes that we do in the development process, permitting process for that same project. I just keep thinking about the Senate bill or assembly bill that had gone forward or that was being proposed for a while that said if, you know, you had a bus line that came by every 10 to 15 minutes, then you could completely change housing along that corridor. And I kept thinking about how most of Hollister would count for that. And is most of Hollister truly a space that you can be without a bus? And there are parts yes, and parts maybe not so much. And so I just think we have to be really thoughtful about what it means and ask for more when we're thinking about transit-oriented development. I'm very excited about reducing parking, for example, on transit-oriented developments, but would like to make sure those projects are going the extra mile in terms of providing affordable, accessible, and robust transportation options. But that's more of a general commentary. The language as written in the staff report, I believe, is appropriate. So those are my three general comments, and I will continue to hold that I believe that 1.7 and 1.8 as written in the newest staff report are strong and should be moved forward.
Thank you. Commissioner Ramirez?
Yes, Chair. So I just want to understand, are you wanting us to limit our comments to 1.7, 1.8, or can we kind of give an overview of, you know, our general thoughts?
No, everything, general thoughts.
Okay. One is it's housing element 5.2, and I can't find what page it's on. So if staff can tell me, it's housing element 5.2. I think it has to do with the regional partnership. And while they pull that up, part of the reason why I bring it up is to specifically call out UC Santa Barbara. I think that in that housing element, it talks about kind of a regional collaboration. And I think that while it's outside of Goleta, you know, when it talks about partnerships with, I think it even calls out San Luis Obispo County and maybe even Ventura County, I think that there's no denying that anything that does or does not take place at UC Santa Barbara impacts the city of Goleta, especially when it comes to housing. And I think there was a part of that housing element. Did anybody figure out what page it's on?
Yes, Commissioner, it's on page 10A-19 and 20 and 21. It's a three-page program. It's 10, page 10, 19, 10, 18, 10, 19, and 10, 20. I'm going to say that wrong again.
You got it.
10, 19, big page 37 of the staff report. It's start HE 5.2, community and regional collaboration starts there.
Thank you. There it is. Thank you for that. I knew we would eventually find it. So community and regional collaboration, and it calls out, the city will continue to coordinate housing strategies with other jurisdictions, agencies, and organizations, address housing needs on the South Coast, as well as more regionally in Ventura and San Luis Obispo County. And so, as you know, to all the points I just mentioned about the need for collaboration and partnership with specifically UC Santa Barbara called out in that, if that's appropriate. And part of the reason why I do that is because in one of the other sections, it calls out, you know, I think partnership with Goleta Water District. And as I mentioned, if what does and doesn't take place at UC Santa Barbara impacts us as what we do kind of going forward. And I don't think that's a substantive change. So if, I'd love to hear my colleagues' thoughts on that. And again, it's just a wording. And then overall, Chair, I think that, I don't know which commissioner mentioned kind of needing to lead the way. And I think part of what Goleta needs to do as whatever commissioner said that is lead the way, because we know that, you know, there are many agencies that have failed its constituents when it comes to housing, you know, whether you're making it more affordable, making it more available. And, you know, the state has done the same thing, and then now the state has responded with, you know, forcing cities and agencies to do things that maybe don't make sense. Maybe it is a one-size-fits-all approach that doesn't make sense to Goleta. We see it with ADUs, we see it with SB9, and so I think that, you know, we need to lead the way in a way that makes sense for Goleta. And, you know, I've studied housing policy related to, you know, Santa Monica and the Bay Area, and you know what makes sense over there doesn't necessarily make sense here. And I think that all the public comments that we've had and that we've seen in the past have been focused on doing more for housing, and whether it's through ownership, whether it's through affordable, whether it's through just the availability of it. And I think that at times we as a commission, as policymakers on the council, and just as an organization also need to be reflective in the knowing that sometimes the things that we do, even if they may have the right intentions, may have indirect consequences that may actually hinder and hurt what it is that we're trying to do. And you know, I'm supportive of the housing element as presented. You know, of course, I have my concerns about, you know, how we use the data that we're researching and what that is. But I think the goal is the same, right? It's to provide housing for our residents and for those that want to call Goleta home. And so I'd support it kind of as presented tonight, with the addition of the UC Santa Barbara being called out. That's all for now, Chair.
Thank you. Any other comments? Is anybody ready to try to draft a motion? Commissioner Maynard?
Actually, sorry, I'm going to take my comment back.
any other comments? Are there any other topics? Or again, is anyone ready to make a motion? Commissioner Ramirez?
I will try to make a motion, Chair. Give me 1 second so I can pull up the... Is the motion...
There it is.
Thank you to staff. All right, so I will make a motion to adopt resolution number 22- to be determined, entitled a resolution of the Planning Commission of the City of Goleta, California, recommending to the City Council submittal of the draft 2023-2031 housing element to the California Department of Housing and Community Development, which would include the recommendations by staff outlined in the staff report and the UC Santa Barbara in 5.2. That is my motion, Chair.
And then Commissioner Ramirez, does that include 1.7 and 1.8?
Yes.
Thank you.
We have any discussion or any seconds?
I'll second.
We try for a roll call vote.
Commissioner McLaren.
You're muted. Or is he frozen? His camera's off. Commissioner McLaren. Commissioner McLaren, are you there? You're muted and we can't see you. Do we continue with the vote without him?
It looks like he may have lost his connection, but we still have a quorum, so I think we can proceed with the vote.
If he comes back on, can we jump back to him? Okay, let's proceed then.
Commissioner Maynard.
I support.
Commissioner Ramirez.
Aye.
And Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Chair Fullerton.
Aye.
I'll go back to Commissioner McLaren.
Looks like he's connecting.
Right. Sure. Oh, awesome.
For sure. Hello? Yes.
I didn't hear the last minute or two.
We were doing a roll call vote, so we're asking your vote.
For Commissioner Ramirez's motion, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess I missed the comment period because but I'm gonna say no. Or nay, excuse me.
Okay. Well, the motion was approved. So I guess the next item is the director's report.
Thank you very much, Chair. I really don't have much by way of a report this evening. I just wanted to alert the commission that our next meeting is scheduled for June 13th. At this point, we have just one item that evening. I will be out of town on vacation myself, so current planning manager Lisa Prossi will be bringing that item forward in my absence. And we will then be back again, I believe, on the following meeting will be June 27th after that.
Okay, thank you.
Is it too early to know what the item will be for June 13th?
It is. We're still finalizing that agenda. But we will alert the commission and the public as soon as we have a final agenda on that.
Thank you, Director Imhoff.
Okay, thank you. Next item is Planning Commission comments. Do we have any comments from the planning commissioners? It's like no. Okay, so do we have a motion for adjournment?
Move for adjournment.
Second?
I'll second.
Okay, roll call vote.
Commissioner McLaren?
Aye.
Commissioner Ramirez?
Aye.
Commissioner Maynard?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Chair Fullerton?
Aye. Okay, meeting adjourned. Thank you.